Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
And right now, Thomas Hearns is an open book for Ray Leonard. Backs up against the ropes.
This is one of the most unusual calls by a referee in the history of the sport.
The first loss.
A tremendous victory. Leonard fighting off the ropes.
It happened. It happened. An uppercut by Douglas. Down goes Tyson. Hooks in. Right hand shot.
Leonard's over. Knocks out by Tyson.
Now slumps to the canvas.
The champion struggles to stay on his feet.
How do you like it?
Welcome, fight fans, to another episode of BTR Boxing Podcast Legendary Nights. And on today's episode, as voted for by the users of Twitter and the listeners, this is the tale of Mike Tyson versus James Buster Douglas from February 1990. Thank you, first of all, to Doug Campbell at DC Sports Value on Twitter for putting the picks out for this particular poll. Great picks in it, and I'm really excited to be talking about one of the biggest shocks, if not the biggest shock upset in modern boxing history, where Mike Tyson went over to Tokyo and he faced off against 42-1 James Buster Douglas. Regular guest on the show and co-host of the Legendary Nights series, Johnston Brown, is on the line to discuss the tale of Tyson versus Douglas from February 1990. But before we get into the episode and start to talk about one of the biggest upsets in boxing history, I want to thank the guys that have listened to my messages on the podcast about going over and rating us, in particular on Apple Podcast. I've noticed a couple of extra ratings on there this week with some great reviews from an N. Stewart. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. You've made my week with a great review of the podcast. I implore people to please keep going on to Apple Podcast or onto Podbean or to Stitcher, Spreaker, Player FM, Spotify. We really appreciate all the support that you're giving us, and even just an extra couple of ratings a week really helps boost our podcast up there, up the rankings. When you go and search for boxing podcasts, you're going to see us a little bit more because we are getting the support that we need to get us up there. And remember, we're independent. We don't have this big platform to do these episodes on. We don't have a studio to do it on. We don't hire someone's studio to do it out. We literally go off the basic equipment that you need to be able to produce and edit a podcast. So please keep going on and rating the podcast. Keep going on and subscribing on all the available platforms. And please go and tell your friends about us on social media and tag us in, because it's really appreciated and it really helps. So enough of the housekeeping rules. Let's get into this episode then. This is the tale of Mike Tyson versus James Buster Douglas, the biggest upset in boxing history.
And we are live inside Korakuen Stadium in Tokyo, Japan, as HBO Sports presents World Championship Boxing. Tonight, undisputed heavyweight champion Mike Tyson's 10th title defense against the challenger James Buster Douglas. It is scheduled for 12 rounds.
So this is it. This is the tale of Mike Tyson versus James Buster Douglas from way back in February 1990. Johnston, this is a fight I know, as always, we've both been looking forward to because it is the biggest upset in boxing history and one of the biggest upsets in sporting history.
Absolutely, Sean. It really was a massive shock at the time. And as you say, definitely one of the greatest sporting upsets in history, let alone boxing. And it's a great one to cover. I mean, we all love Tyson and it's great to go through his career and obviously what happened before and after and obviously Buster Douglas as well, who shot to fame through his victory. So really looking forward to going through this one with you.
As always, with the Legendary Nights series, what we're going to do is we're going to cover off both careers leading up to the famous bout. We're going to cover off the build-up because this build-up has got so many intricate details for us to discuss with things that happened in the lead-up to this particular fight for both men that it's probably going to take us at least half an hour to go through that. But I am very much looking forward to it because there is a lot of good stuff to cover off with this particular fight. And we'll cover the fight breakdown and we'll also cover the aftermath of what happened for both men in their careers and their lives after this epic bout. So let's begin and go to Mr. James Buster Douglas first, and let's look a little bit into his career leading up to this particular bout, because not a lot of people remember what James Buster Douglas achieved other than this particular win over Mike Tyson. And I said this to you before we started this episode, that it feels like James Buster Douglas was this one-hit wonder, a guy who'd released a music album or a song and we never heard from him again. And that actually, in reality, was kind of what his career was like, because going back to his career, he didn't really have the most successful of careers in terms of what he achieved overall in the sport. However, this particular fight was what put him on the map because of what he got out of the victory and what it led to on the back of the victory as well. But he didn't actually get any success until sort of 6 years into his career when he really started to push on. And the first major bout he was involved in was in 1987. Bearing in mind he'd been a pro for 6 years at this point, and he went in to fight for the vacant IBF heavyweight title of the world against Tony Tucker, who was 33-0 at the time. And this particular fight with Tony Tucker did showcase that Buster Douglas did have talent, and this was for most people the first time they really got to see Buster Douglas as the talented fighter that he was at the time in the heavyweight division. However, he lost to Tony Tucker. He seemed to run out of steam in that fight. Watching that back, he was quite a talented fighter, but he ran out of steam against Tony Tucker and eventually got stopped on his feet, and that was his first attempt at a world title. But then he goes in the ring and fights again, gets a good few wins under his belt, including wins over Trevor Burbeck and Oliver McCall before he got this fight with Mike Tyson. So he did have some great notable names on his record leading up to the fight with Tyson, and which is why he got the fight with Tyson. But going over to yourself, Johnston, when you look at James Buster Douglas's career, other than obviously this big fight that we're talking about this evening, would you have thought of James Buster Douglas as a name to have popped out as a heavyweight great? Or is it just a case of he's always going to be associated with Mike Tyson because of the victory?
It's this victory. This is his biggest moment in his career. As you say, obviously, the Tony Tucker fight was... He was up on the scorecards before he just began to tire, really, and he just quit, basically. I was just thinking, probably not quit, he was just done, basically. He blew his gas tank, if you like. But he was doing well from the beginning, so there was obviously some talent there. But, you know, this is what he will always be remembered as, the biggest upset in the history of heavyweight championship boxing. That is what Buster Douglas will always be known for. But as you have already mentioned, in terms of he had that run where he beat Trevor Burbeck, he beat Oliver McCall just before the Tyson fight. He also beat Mike Williams as well. He was also a pretty decent name on there. After the Tony Tucker defeat, he obviously sorted himself out. I think he had, I believe, reading stuff, because obviously I don't remember Buster Douglas until the day, obviously, the 1990 fight with Tyson. So, but he did have a disagreement, I believe, with his father. So he split with his father after the tackle fight. And then, obviously, it worked in his favour because he did go on this good run to get himself in pole position to fight Mike Tyson in 1990 in Tokyo.
Well, when we go back to the fights with Trevor Burbeck and Oliver McCall, you've got to remember that Trevor Burbeck was the man Mike Tyson beat to win his first world heavyweight title, which is something we'll touch on when we speak about Tyson's career. So Trevor Burbeck at this point when he beat him was 1989, Tyson beat him in 86 to win the world title. So Trevor Burbeck was obviously a former world champion in his own right, and when he beat him in 1989, when Douglas beat him, that was a fantastic win for him, a great win over Mike Williams, as you rightly pointed out, and then obviously a young Oliver McCall, who would eventually go on to become a world champion, getting a shock win over Lennox Lewis later on down the line in his career. So when you look back at the names, actually there's three or four good names he really was involved with throughout the course of his career, and as we touch on in the aftermath of this particular bout, we'll be talking about some of the other names that he was involved with. But when I think about James Buster Douglas, obviously the only thing I think about is Mike Tyson, and the two go together, and the two will always go together. And it's for James Buster Douglas that he will always be remembered as the guy who beat Mike Tyson. So he had what could have been an average career, but with this particular victory that we're talking about and this fight we're talking about, it turned it into a more than average career. It turned it into a great career, the fact that he went in against an undisputed champion and got the victory. So he, going into this fight, he'd had a great apprenticeship going into it, especially beating the likes of Williams, Burbeck and McCall. They were three great victories, as you said, on the bounce, which led to him being ranked highly enough to be given an opportunity to fight Mike Tyson. When he beat all three of them names I've mentioned, that put him in position to be ranked by the IBF at number 2, the WBC at number 3, and the WBA at number 4, and they were happy for James Buster Douglas to be the next defence for all of them belts when he went in with Mike Tyson. So let's move to Mike Tyson then, because there's obviously going to be a lot more to talk about with Mike Tyson, because at this time in history, he was the best thing since sliced bread. He was the next coming of the heavyweight division. He was the new era of heavyweight boxing at this moment in time. And he had an absolute fantastic resume on his career going into this fight, that the likes of the guys that he beat going up to this particular fight with James Buster Douglas, it made him the invincible guy he was. It made him the baddest man on the planet. It made him Iron Mike Tyson. This was what everybody loved about the guy: the ferociousness, the uppercuts, the head movement, the fact that he was only about 5'10", 5'11". You know, he wasn't your typical heavyweight 6 foot plus. This guy would come in underneath and he would throw shots into the such bigger guys, and he was used to fighting bigger guys. So going back to Tyson then, early memories of him, Johnston. I know you was a big fan of Tyson, as was I. When was the first time you encountered him as a fighter growing up?
Well, as a kid, I followed Bruno. I was with my brother. My brother was a Bruno fan, so I always he was a family favourite, if you like. Real love Bruno. So when he obviously fought the first time against Mike Tyson in 89, that was probably the time that I knew of Tyson already. I was only 8 or 8, 9 years old, so I knew how destructive he was. I mean, he was just a formidable force, wasn't he? He was just unbelievable. He was just dominating bigger guys, older guys, series, some of these fellas, they weren't just journeymen. These were the former world champions, or they were world champions to be. You know, he's just unbelievable. It's ferocious. He's terrifying. Every single opponent he ever fought, literally, you could just see it in their eyes. With Spinks, with Burbeck, with even Bruno, he just literally scared the life out of these guys. I knew of Tyson as a youngster. He was one of the first boxers I ever heard of. So Tyson has always been, always been a keen admirer of his fights. I mean, he was interesting to watch, but as I say, with Frank Bruno, I always rooted for Bruno, but unfortunately, he didn't quite come up trumps against Tyson, because he was just an animal.
Well, going back to then Tyson's career, obviously in America he was really sought after at the point he turned professional, because when he turned professional he'd had a really good amateur career leading up to it under Customato, and obviously then going into his professional career he just started to knock fighters out for the fun of it. You know, he was knocking guys out left, right and centre, and he was getting this reputation as a ferocious puncher, and as time went on, you know, it was ridiculous, like looking back on the amount of fights he had to get him to that world title level before he went in with Trevor Burbick for his first world title. You're looking 1985 when he turned professional. He had like, I think it was like a dozen fights. I think it was something along the line of a 15. Dozen fights. 15, there you go, yeah. 15 fights he was involved in his first year as a professional. It's totally unheard of in this day and age. There's no way you would see any professional in 2019 going in the ring and having 15 fights. But he was knocking them all out for fun, that was the thing. So he was really fresh, really active, and I don't think they rushed him. Looking back, I think it was the right thing for them to do, because he was really fresh. He was knocking them out for fun. He weren't even breaking a sweat with half of the guys he was going in the ring with. And when he started to up the level against the guys like James Tillis and Mitch Green, that's when you started to know he was the real deal. Although them two guys took him the distance in 1986, it shown that he was ready to sort of step up to the world level. He then beat the nephew of the late Joe Frazier, Marvis Frazier, in 1986, who was 16-1 at the time, and then he'd beat Jose Ribalta and Alfonso Ratliff, both by TKO victories, within the space of a month of each other, before then he got this fight with Trevor Burbick, which was in the November of 1986, and was for the WBC heavyweight title.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
And it was his first big stage, and what a historic night it was. When he beat Trevor Burbick, it made him the youngest ever heavyweight champion in boxing history at just the age of 20.
Yeah, that record still remains today. Unbelievable, isn't it, really? Those, you know, all those fights in 1985. And it was a turbulent sort of year for him, because obviously his mum died in 84, just before he turned pro, and then obviously Customato was, you know, he was an older guy. For people that didn't know, he was Floyd Patterson's trainer, sort of a decade or a couple of decades before. So, you know, he was an established name. Actually, I've got a quote that Customato, when he actually set eyes on Mike Tyson, he was a 13-year-old, and he said, "That's the future heavyweight champion in the world." So he knew straight away. I mean, he was 13 years old, Tyson, scaling, you know, tipping the scales at 200 pounds. So, you know, for a short guy, as you say, like in heavyweight, sort of, you know, in terms of heavyweights, he was, you know, 5'11 or whatever he was. I mean, 200 pounds he was weighing at 13 years old is just pure muscle. I mean, the guy was just an animal. So, but yeah, although he was blazing guys out sort of in the first round, as I say, his mum had died, become his legal guardian, and then a year later Cuff died. But fortunately, like with the trio, as in it was Bill Caton and it was Jim Jacobs. So those three were sort of a trio that sort of kept Tyson grounded, if you like. So as he was bursting through these guys in 85, it was like he had a good network behind him. So it would have gone off the rails as a youngster. They stabilised him, and that was always a major factor for Tyson. He needed that, I think, for Tyson to just continue to just be as successful as he was in the ring. And obviously with the Mitch Green as well, he was a he's a colourful character, Mitch Green. There was a bit of drama with Mitch Blood Green because he was going to pull out of that fight because they only gave him 30 grand and I believe he thought he was going to get more. In the end, they convinced him to take the fight and he took him the distance. But still to this day, I think Mitch Green still bangs on about the fact that he deserves a rematch. He should get more money. So quite funny, but we'll come back on to Mitch Green later on as we go across Tyson's career. But yeah, I mean, it was in no time, was it really? That Trevor Burbick fight, he could tell Trevor weren't interested. He was petrified, and it was part of the Heavyweight Undisputed series, which was also produced by HBO and promoted by Don King. So you know, it was a load of fighters that were WBC, WBA, and IBF. So no WBO at the time, but they were all champions. They were trying to find the established undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. So this was the first fight sort of for Tyson in the series, and he absolutely demolished Burbick in two rounds.
He did, and that was like the equivalent of the World Boxing Super Series in 2019. They got the best fighters around at the time, the best champions around at the time, and made them basically all face off against one another to see who was going to be the undisputed champion. The next opponent was James Boncusher Smith, who has been on our podcast. He's been on BTR Boxing Podcast, and we interviewed him for the Life and Times of. And one of obviously the questions was about Mike Tyson, and one of the things he always said was that when he got hit, oh damn sure he got hurt, but he weren't going down. And that was one thing he said, was that a lot of the opponents of Tyson around that era were always petrified of him. You know, a lot of them lost the fight before they'd even stepped in the ropes because of this aura of him being able to knock all the opponents out. So he went 12 rounds, James Boncusher Smith, with Mike Tyson. And as a result, Mike Tyson then picked up James Smith's WBA world title. So he then became a double champion at this point. He then defended it again 2 months later against Pinkman Thomas by stopping Pinkman Thomas quite emphatically as well, and then he moved on to the next part of this undisputed series, which was 1987, by picking up the IBF title as well, beating Tony Tucker, who was 34-0 at this point. By the way, he was obviously another great name on the resume because he was undefeated, and this was a big deal back in 1987. This was a guy that was potentially going to go in there and upset the apple cart, but he didn't. He lasted the distance with Tyson. Tyson gave him a hell of a night, and Tony Tucker give Tyson a hell of a night. But then by this point, 1987, a 21-year-old Mike Tyson had 3 world titles to his name.
Oh, it was just blazing through him, wasn't it? I mean, you talk about Trevor Burbick destroying him, obviously. Smith, as you've mentioned, who's been on the show, he's a great listener, by the way. I do have a listen to that. Pinkman Thomas, and then obviously the Tony Tucker fight. And funny enough, Tony Tucker had actually beaten Douglas as well in the series. So you know, ironically, that could have been Douglas. You know, if Douglas had have managed to continue the way he started the fight against Tony Tucker, he could have gone on to win that on points. But unfortunately for him, it wasn't to be. But as you say, Tony Tucker was undefeated at the time, and you know he had won the IBF title from against Douglas, because Spinks had actually been stripped of his title because Spinks decided to fight Jerry Cooney instead of Tucker, because it was more of a lucrative deal when it was more money involved. So you know, there was again, you know, this 87, and there's still politics there with the IBF stripping fighters, and you know, inevitably, I think we all wanted that. Well, you know, I say we, the fans watching at the time. I mean, I was a youngster, you were a youngster, so we weren't around. But you know, you could imagine the fans wanting to, they really wanted to see Spinks Tyson. Unfortunately, that wasn't to be. But Tucker performed, you know, he put in a great performance against Tyson, and was unfortunate. I mean, in the end, he lost on points. But again, Tyson was just formidable, wasn't he? He was just looking dangerous, and it was just a matter of time before he won the series, basically.
Well, then he moved on to beat Tyrell Biggs, defending them 3 titles 2 months after beating Tony Tucker. He then beat Larry Holmes. Now, the interesting Larry Holmes fight was that people will know that before the fight, Muhammad Ali was in the ring with Mike Tyson, and from this is what Tyson is obviously quoted to say, was that he went, go and get him for me, go and get him for me. I can't exactly say they were the 100% the guaranteed words that were said, but in various different interviews that you will hear over the years, especially Tyson himself, Larry Holmes had obviously beaten a former sort of shell of himself in Muhammad Ali earlier on in the 1980s, as he was at the end of his career, Muhammad Ali. And Muhammad Ali basically says, you know, you're the future of heavyweight boxing, to Mike Tyson, and whispers in his ear in the ring just as the fight's about to start, go and get him for me, or go and do him for me. I think it was one of the other that he actually said to him, and he absolutely obliterated Larry Holmes, who had been a wonderful champion throughout the late 70s and 1980s going up to this point. He was an absolute monster of a heavyweight champion when it was his time as heavyweight king, and Tyson went in there and absolutely destroyed him.
Oh, absolutely destroyed. I mean, he was obviously coming to the end of his career, Larry, and, you know, he went on for a while, didn't he? But, he was an established guy, and obviously he was the link as well, wasn't he? Was that first link. He was Larry Holmes beating Ali, and then obviously Tyson beating Holmes. It's almost like a link, a chain, if you like, between Ali and Tyson. Obviously, as you say, Ali being in the ring as well, saying, go and get him for me. That was probably the significant fight in terms of was it plausible at the time that maybe, you know, is Tyson going to dominate the heavyweight division? I think it was pretty clear. It was just a matter of if it could happen or not. And, you know, I think most people sort of relating, would Iron Mike, would it be a challenging the likes of Joe Lewis's record, for instance? And you know, that was just, you know, those links were, you know, you can't deny that. Tyson was just unbelievable. It was, as you say, I mean, these guys were established fellas, and to just do what he did to Larry Holmes is unbelievable. And again, this is a time when Tyson was starting to derail a little bit, because again, Jacobs, he was one of the sort of, so he lost Carson in, and then Jacobs died in 1988 of leukemia. So then you had this issue, because he also had his new wife, who was actually in the crowd at the time as well, that watched the Larry Holmes fight, who was Givens. Is that her name? I always forget her first name.
Robin Givens.
That's right. Yeah. So, and obviously she had a famous mum, so her and Don King, so they were sort of like the devils, if you like. The devils is probably a bad way of putting it, but they were like the devil in his ear, telling him to get rid of Caton, who's the last remaining of that trio that kept sort of Tyson grounded. So there were signs of problems developing after that Larry Holmes fight, and obviously being in the public. And then Givens, I think in June 1988, she actually came out publicly and said that, you know, that he had been beating her up. And Tyson come out with a quote saying that, with a grin, sort of basically just saying that if I had a hit her, then, you know, I would have ripped her head off. So there's basically, it's all lies, and he never laid a finger on her. So these were the sort of things that were happening in the background, sort of in the build up to the Douglas. And obviously, he was still knocking people out. He was still doing his business in the ring. But, you know, it is these sort of bits that eventually takes his toll on us.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where we start to talk about these types of things when we lead into the build up to the particular fight. And touching on the fights that were happening in the ring while all this was going on outside the ring, he beat Tony Tubbs in his first trip over to Tokyo, which was a great win for him, stopping Tony Tubbs. He then had a great build up to a fight with Michael Spinks. Now, that fight was so heavily built up because Michael Spinks was 31-0 at the time. He was obviously being touted as the guy that could potentially derail Tyson at this point in time, and Tyson absolutely obliterated him in the first round before moving on to our very own and very beloved Frank Bruno, which, looking back on the Frank Bruno fight, I thought that was an excellent fight. When you look back on it, it was a very exciting fight. Obviously, Bruno had failed in his previous attempts at becoming world champion and was going in against a prime Mike Tyson, and I will never forget, and it sends shivers up my spine at the moment, we'd seen that little bit of chink in the armour from Mike Tyson the moment Bruno landed a left hook on Tyson, and then you had, I think it was Reg Gutteridge doing the commentary app going absolutely ballistic when Frank Bruno had landed that shot on Mike Tyson. But Mike Tyson, as ferocious as he was, still managed to walk through it and eventually stop Frank Bruno. And Frank Bruno gave an absolutely valiant effort. And then he goes in one more time before the Douglas fight and fights Carl Williams and getting another stoppage.
Yeah, the Bruno fight was obviously, I was talking about it with you beforehand, and I was in Primer Square having a debate with my friend about who was going to win, and I thought Bruno would win, you know, 8 years old, 9 years old. You could probably forgive me for thinking that, because there was no chance that Bruno was going to ever win the fight. But again, I mean, that Bruno fight, what a fight. You know, if anyone ain't seen it, go back and have a look on YouTube. It's brilliant. And you know, Bruno rocking Tyson, that was unbelievable to witness that. I mean, everybody, as you said, I think, was it Harry Carpenter that said, I think it might have been Harry Carpenter that said, he knows he's hurting, and he even says, get in there, Frank. And he still says to this day that he really regrets the fact that he actually backed someone during commentary, because he never likes to do that. So, but yeah, that was just, it does send goosebumps down your spine, and it really does. It's just a great watch if no one's ever seen it. But in terms of before the fight as well, going back to Mitch Green, it was an ironic situation where at 3 a.m, I think it was Brooklyn or wherever it was in New York, Mike Tyson at 3 a.m. decided to go and get a coat from this coat place, some sort of, I don't know, I can't remember the exact name, but in the end, you know, Mitch Green was a little bit partial to a bit of angel dust, so he shows up at 3 a.m. demanding the money from the fight that he had with him a couple of years beforehand, and obviously Tyson whacks him and knocks him out, and there's actually pictures of Mitch Green with a massive shiner, so if he, you know, you could have a look at it and see the footage. It's all over the sort of New York Times at the time. And actually, from that punch, it was Tyson actually fractured his hand. So that's why that fight was delayed with Bruno after the Spinks fight. But again, Spinks, his face, I will never forget Spinks' face. It just looked, the pure just fear in his eyes. He wouldn't even look at Tyson. And then that was what Tyson was about. He had these guys beaten in the ring before they even stepped in the ring. And I think that will always stick with me, that, you know, although he was so ferocious in the ring, nobody just wanted to get hit by him. And they were just petrified of him. And as you say, going on, and he also then went on to beat Carl Williams as well. But yeah, his life was obviously falling into, he's in self-destruct mode at the time, and everything was just going wrong. And he gets rid of Kevin Rooney, and it's all just a bit of a mess going into the Buster Douglas fight.
I think when we look back on this and we talk about the build-up now, it's quite evident when we talk about some of the factual bits of information that it's definitely looking like it was really only going to go one way. I mean, it's probably some of the worst preparation for a fight you could possibly have, and years down the line we hear all the stories about what really happened in the lead up to the fight, and we've got some interesting bits of information. So you mentioned the fact that he'd ditched Kevin Rooney, who was his longtime trainer and a guy who'd worked closely with him for a number of years, got into that level, and then he ditched Kevin Rooney. There were so many influences and so many hangers on around him at this point, it was untrue. So all the people that had kept him grounded up until this point were gone or had passed away. So, you know, you've got guys like Don King, who we could probably sit and do a separate episode on the guy himself because of how slippery and how bad and how much of a money grabber this guy was. It was untrue. And it's funny because, just on a side note, it always reminds me of Rocky V that came out the same year, when they had the promoter of Tommy Gunn, who was definitely had a likeness to Don King. The way he acted and the way they portrayed him in that film was definitely Don King. But moving back onto point, he had so many influences around him at the time, and they weren't the good influences either. So he'd lost Kevin Rooney, he changed his trainer, and...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
He weren't taking orders from his trainer. His trainer's telling him to go on a run, and he'll go, no, I'll go on it when I want to go on it. And stuff like that, in hindsight now, it makes you realise why he lost the fight, really. Because it wasn't just a fantastic performance from Douglas on the night. It was also some of the outside stuff that took precedent in the fight, going into the fight as well. And then obviously you had this stuff with Robin Givens hanging over him, and allegations of him beating Robin Givens. And then, you know, obviously he broke his hand punching Mitch Green, as you was telling that story a minute ago. And there was just so many things in the lead up to this fight. And what made me laugh was when you look back on the build up of the fight and the HBO coverage of the fight, this is something that wouldn't happen in this day and age, but they actually showed footage of Tyson getting dropped in sparring by Greg Page in the lead up to the Douglas fight as well, which is, that is something that you would never see in this day and age. They would never admit whether someone had been dropped in sparring. There'd always be rumours about it, but you'd never publicly admit that someone was dropped in sparring in the lead up to this fight. So really, when you take everything into consideration, it was quite a catastrophic build up for him, wasn't it?
Completely. He was just in an absolute mess. I mean, he was losing it. He was going off the rails. And as I say, you know, the two deaths in his life, and obviously then the split with Kevin Rooney and Caton as well, I think it just impacted his life. And it just fell to pieces. You know, breaking his hand on Mitch Green before the Bruno fight, the delay in that. And then he knocked himself out, crashing his BMW into a tree. He went berserk in Moscow, where his wife was filming him, smashing TV cameras, chasing Givens and his mother through the hotel lobby. Then Givens files for divorce. That was the reason why he was all chasing hurling furniture into the street. And then he leaves... I mean, it was just a mess. Kevin, obviously, he sacks Kevin Rooney, and then Bill Caton's out the door and Don King's in it. As you said, it's hard to believe that you didn't think he could lose, because he was so, even though this, you know, this was going on for, and he's still knocking people out in the ring, so maybe people just assume that, you know, he's going to be fine and he'll just be another body on his record. But, you know, Buster Douglas, to his credit, he proved everyone wrong. And he was also going through some bad times, because he had just lost his mother a few months before. So he had that sort of, you know, that sort of pushing him on and being the underdog. And I think that sparked something in Buster Douglas. And so you had two guys going into the ring completely separate. You know, one was almost on the decline, or was on the decline, and you had the other one who was having this little spurt, this little purple patch in his boxing career. So, you know, you think about it, it was definitely one of the biggest, you know, it was 42-1. And it was, you know, I think it was the Mirage, wasn't it? The only ones that actually put a bet on, like you could put a bet on him. So, it was just one of those situations where it was going to happen. It was just something that was going to happen. And it happened in Tokyo. And you know, he had the Tokyo round him beforehand as well. So he was a mess. And he fought like nothing like I've ever seen before. He wasn't the Mike Tyson we had seen all those years, just literally destructing every single opponent that passed into, he got in the ring with.
Today's episode of BTR Boxing Podcast is sponsored by Bear Attack Boxing. Check them out on social media, on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And check out their website, www.bearattackboxing.co.uk. They've got another great product that's just been released, the Bear Attack Boxing Master 1 Focus Pads. Now, they are the ideal pads for perfecting your boxing skills, for getting your shots accurate and fast. With the shock absorbent pad, your hands and wrists will be protected. The hook and loop strap makes it easy to secure your hands in the pads. So go and check out that new product, which is only $24.99 at www.bearattackboxing.co.uk. Social media, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Find them, Bear Attack Boxing. But when you talk about the build-up for Buster Douglas as well, you talk about the fact that he'd lost his mother. Now, he lost his mother, he was only 23 days before the fight that he actually lost his mum. And he was really, really close to his mum, and all the interviews that have taken place beforehand, taken place after the event, you know, it was such a significant period in his life, because at this point in time, he'd earned his way back up to a shot at the World Heavyweight title. As I said earlier, he was ranked number 2, number 3 and number 4 by the respective governing bodies, so he'd earned his way there, but the setbacks he suffered through no fault of his own in the lead up to this particular fight, this would be enough excuses for him to have lost that particular fight, really. The fact that he'd lost his mum 23 days before the fight.
Great deal to me, and I'm going to miss her tremendously. But, you know, it's got to go on.
The fact that he also had the mother of his son, who was facing a severe kidney ailment, and she'd contracted flu the day before the fight. You know, this would make some people actually say, no, I'm not going ahead with it. You know, people would pull out in certain circumstances like this. But there was obviously just something about James Buster Douglas where it was like, what's the worst now that can happen to him? He's lost his mum, who he loved dearly. The mother of his son's really poorly, and there's obviously a concern over the welfare of the son because the mother was so poor. But yet he still managed to keep his focus going into this particular fight. So you think about the stuff that had gone on with Mike Tyson, that was by choice for Tyson because of his mental state of mind at the time. But for Douglas, none of that was by choice. That was all circumstantial because of what had happened outside of the ring. So when you dive deeper into the situation, really, I think for me, it makes me feel like the writing is completely on the wall when it comes to the events that happened in the fight, which is what we're going to move on to in a second. We're going to move on to the fight and talk about the fight itself. The fact that it was held in Japan was all about the money, because he'd been there 2 years before Tyson. The Japanese decided that they wanted him back because he was such a big draw that they actually paid $6 million to the boxing officials for the privilege of staging this particular fight in Tokyo. So you had guys like Don King who was smelling the money. He was smelling that money, and you know for a fact, as soon as the Japanese offered that sort of money, he was taking it, and it didn't really matter. But the whole distraction of everything outside of the ring that you referred to, you know, it was unbelievable to think that this fight went as long as it did, and things didn't end so soon, because that sort of catastrophic build-up for Tyson would have made most fighters lose, in my opinion, a lot sooner. But I think that was because of who Tyson was, why it went as long as it did. But then, like we say with Douglas, most men would have probably quit. Most men would have just said, no, I can't go ahead with the fight. But he was so obviously mentally in focus. And the thing was, with this, there was no fear at all from James Buster Douglas going into this fight. Like I said earlier, what is the worst that the world and life could have threw at him? He'd suffered it. He'd suffered it in the lead up to the fight. He'd suffered some of the worst things in life that you can go through. So he was 100% mentally in a place where he could fully focus on this fight, given everything that had happened outside of the ring. And it was unbelievable to think that this guy had gone through all this in the lead up to the biggest fight of his life. Unbelievable.
Completely, and you know, even his trainer, JD McCauley, it was his uncle as well, at the time said, after his mum died, was, I think if anything, James will turn this into a positive. I really believe that. And that's exactly what he did. You hit the nail on the head, Sean. He was completely in a different frame of mind to what Mike Tyson was. And also, the other thing was, with everything else that was going on, he's got a divorce, he's lost his trainer, he's just in free fall, he's not listening to anybody. The other thing was that Don King, he's already setting up a fight for Evander Holyfield, who was sitting in the crowd waiting for a multi-million fight against Mike Tyson, just expecting him to blast him off. So you know, in the back of his mind, he thought we had this fight done. And I think, you know, there's only one article, or, you know, one person in particular that I could find that actually sort of backed Douglas, and that was a guy 4 days before the fight, Dave Anderson of the New York Times, and he wrote, considering his competition, the only person who can beat Tyson is himself. By not training, by not caring, by not surrounding himself with experienced cornermen, chances are Tyson will quickly swap James Buster Douglas into submission. Even so, reports from Tokyo, Tyson's training are enough to question if the champion is sabotaging his own regime. While sparring with Greg Page 2 weeks ago, he was floored by an overhand right. Over the weekend, he was described as sluggish and in another sparring session. So, you know, he was probably the only guy that was alluding to the fact that, you know, the chances are
Tyson could lose this, and he would lose it himself. Although Buster Douglas, he put in the best performance of his life, and he turned all of his negatives into a positive. Whereas, Tyson was just in free fall. So yeah, it was chaos, wasn't it? Really, and the Tyson camp and the people that he was surrounding himself with were just involved in the money, and that was all that mattered. So, and Douglas was in it for the boxing, and he wanted to do it for his mum, and that is enough of that's going to get you going, isn't it? That will just ignite you on the night, and he was ready to go.
It was funny because also in the build-up on the night of the fight, HBO boxing analysts Larry Merchant and Jim Lampley, both famous for some of the quotes and comments they came out with over the years during the HBO boxing period, they both expected it to be another 90-second annihilation. They really did. They were both quite negative about the fact that Douglas doesn't really have much of a chance here. And even on the night of the fight, instead of discussing Douglas' chances against Tyson, they actually sat there talking about comparing pets, as in Tyson had got a white pit bull named Duran after his idol, and then Douglas had a beagle named Shakespeare, and and then Merchant was quoted as saying, "This fight is over before it begins or soon thereafter," and he was comparing James Buster Douglas to just another frozen tuna from the Tokyo fish markets.
Larry, what are we about to see? Another 90-second annihilation of an ill-prepared opponent?
Well, in the important game of expectations, this fight is over before it begins or soon thereafter. You have to remember that just nobody believes anybody can compete with Mike Tyson. In fact, Ed Schuyler of the Associated Press, when he arrived in Tokyo, was asked by a customs official what he was doing here. He said he was here to cover the Tyson-Douglas fight. "How long do you expect to work?" the customs official asked. "Oh," he said, "about 90 seconds. The good news is that Douglas has fought his best fighters against the best fighters he's fought, so perhaps we'll get a few rounds. Also, Jim, Douglas has a dog, a beagle named Shakespeare, and I believe that any prize fighter with a dog named Shakespeare can't be all bad."
Buster Douglas tells us that his favorite Shakespearean play is the romantic tragedy Romeo and Juliet. Surely if Mike Tyson were asked that question, he would choose something more bloody and violent, perhaps Henry V or Macbeth.
Things like that are just like, nobody was giving him a chance. And this is what I'm trying to put into context of the fact that how big of an underdog James Buster Douglas was going into this particular fight, that even the HBO commentators, who are supposed to be impartial, by the way, are actually basically saying to the viewers of the broadcast that, yeah, it's going to be over in 90 seconds, is a frozen tuna fish from the market. I don't think you could be any more insulting towards a fighter than that, really. And it was ridiculous, but hey ho, let's move on to the fight and let's go into this particular fight. And this is where it becomes a great talk, really, because this is a fight that people will never ever forget, and we say it time and time and again, is one of the biggest upset, if not the biggest upset in boxing history, and one of the biggest upsets in sporting history because of how it went down. And all the stuff we've just talked about in the build-up leads nicely into the fight, because from the beginning of the fight you could see that Douglas wasn't afraid. He came out and he weren't afraid. He didn't go into a shell, he didn't go on the back foot, he went straight out. And he went straight out for Tyson, and he was using lateral movement straight away, and he wasn't even cautious. He let his punches go straight away, and that was what was quite impressive about watching the fight, is that you could see them straight away. There was no fear with him. He didn't care. He was there to do a job and become heavyweight champion of the world.
And he like so many other Tyson opponents, they were beaten before they stepped in that ring, and Douglas wasn't. He had been through the worst thing that he had ever gone through in his life, losing his mother only 23 days ago. So that in his head, he's not going to be scared fighting of a Mike Tyson in the ring. What's the worst that could happen? Well, just put down and then fight another day off, So he was brilliant. He dominated that opening round, literally no fear, used his 12-inch reach to his advantage to perfection, and just continually hit Tyson with jabs and right hands. And he danced out of reach from Tyson as soon as Tyson tried to go on the inside. So it's from the beginning of the fight, straight away, it was evident that who was in complete control. Whether he, when you watch it at the time, you're probably expecting it doesn't really matter because Tyson's eventually going to land. But he surprised a lot of people. As you already said, you know, Jim Lampley and Larry Merchant were laughing and joking about the names of their dogs and also the fact that 90 seconds and annihilation was what they predicted. So good start for Douglas, and he proved a lot of people wrong from the off on that first round.
What was impressive about the work from Buster Douglas in the opening two rounds of the fight was that he was using them physical advantages to not let Tyson get on the inside, because as we alluded to earlier in the episode, Tyson was really good against big guys. He used the fact that he was a smaller heavyweight to be able to get underneath the jab, slip on the inside and throw the uppercuts in, which was one of his trademark punches. But Douglas had obviously already had this worked out. Douglas was not letting him get on the inside. And ironically enough, what was funny about the whole fight from the start was that Douglas was in control, and then he actually finished the second round with a little snappy uppercut to Tyson's chin at the end of the second round, which I thought was a brilliant shot. And I think there's an absolute fantastic picture of it on Google Images. If you go and search for it, it's a brilliant shot of where he lands that uppercut, and it's just, it's ironic. It was an ironic shot that he'd landed, given that it was Tyson's trademark shot. And what a great end to that second round, and what a great start to the fight.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Douglas is getting Mike Tyson to reach in. When you reach in, that's what happens.
Another good right hand and a good right uppercut and two more good rights by Douglas. I don't think I've ever seen Tyson absorb that kind of a four or five punch combination before in his professional career.
Now, Mike is not going on. He's not attacking Buster Douglas, which indicates that there is some respect here.
And also a little puzzlement, Ray. He just doesn't seem to know how to go about it. That's another good round that I gave to Buster Douglas.
Oh, I know exactly the picture you're talking about. It was a wonderful shot, wasn't it? Great uppercut. And yeah, who would have thought it, for a big guy as well, you know, to be catching Tyson with uppercut. It shows you that there was just no defense at all. There was no, yeah, he had that peekaboo start, didn't he? And that sort of just wasn't quite there. And he was just, his hands were too low. He was just literally hitting him at will, wasn't he? It was like he's just using his face as a block, if you like, for Tyson. And, you know, to Tyson's credit, Jesus, he showed he had a downright unbelievable chin. But yeah, that second round, Douglas again still just continued to dominate that fight. And then pretty much the same moving on into the third. Tyson did land a big left to the body, which sort of, you know, got Douglas looking at his corner. But other than that, it was a pretty straightforward round once again for Douglas. You know, he just continued to use his jab and hit that overhand right. He hit the right hand so many times. It was like every round. You just think, surely, at some point, Tyson's going to wake up in a minute and just move his head a bit quicker, which is something he was great at. He was moving, the excellent head work he could do with the bigger guys and get on the inside and just throw those left hooks. And right, he had power in both hands as well. So it wasn't just the left. He could have caught with him with the right. You know, but Tyson a year ago would have done that, and he just didn't do it. And I'm even on the HBO commentary, Sugar Ray Leonard in the third round even said, sometimes, you know, you just don't have it. Things just don't click in for that night. So, you know, mate, that's the way Leonard was seeing it already. On the third round, Leonard's almost sort of seeing that Tyson's he's looking worse for wear, and this could be a long night.
Yeah, and at the end of that third round, it wasn't a good round really for Tyson. It wasn't a good first quarter of the fight, to be honest with you. And so much so that his cornerman, Jay Bright, who he had in for this particular fight, was basically screaming at him and saying, he's like, don't just stand there and look at him, you've got to work. Tyson wasn't working.
Don't just stand there and look at him, you've got to work.
You're not closing the gap, Mike. You got to get inside by jabbing and moving your head. When you get in the inside, you got to punch. All right? Come on, baby. Punch. Well, jab, jab, overhand, right, come back into your foot. Okay, relax.
Oh, you're too flat-footed in there.
Right. Okay?
Trust in what you know. Do it. Let it go.
Tyson wasn't working at all. Tyson was literally turning into a plodder at this point. He was just walking forward and letting the shots come for Buster Douglas. And Douglas then would go on to start to dominate the middle rounds. Tyson would land a few of them signature uppercuts, but Tyson was wobbled by a chopping right during the fifth round. And then it's at that point then that Tyson's, you start to see the physical side of things getting to him a little bit, because you start to see his left eye swell from all the jabs that he'd taken from James Buster Douglas that night, which obviously when you're in the ring and you get an injury to the eye, either a cut or some type of swelling, you're effectively losing some of your vision, if not all of your vision, in that one eye. So you've got to think about, as a fighter in the ring, you lose that vision. You're not going to always see the punches coming.
Oh, definitely. And you know, he used that to his advantage. And he, you know, and credit, it just showed straight away. You were talking about, what, the full fifth round. I think it was the fourth round, you started to see like the little mass appearing, and eventually it just carried on getting worse, because you just kept getting tagged with it, with the jab and the right hand. And then it is just unbelievable that this just says it all about the corner he was with, I'm lost for words. When, if you ever see the picture of the latex glove that is just sort of filled with water and they're pushing up against him. I mean, these guys didn't even bring equipment to the ring with them, because they were that confident that Tyson would get rid of Douglas before this round. They couldn't even conceive the fact they could be getting into the fourth and fifth round, and Tyson could even have any swelling whatsoever. And even at one point, Aaron Snow, who's Tyson's primary corner man, caught a chain. So he had a chain, like an identification badge, hanging from his neck, and it actually caught Tyson's eye. And you can actually see Tyson wince in pain as he drags it through his injured eye to the other. It's literally a bunch of clowns working his corner, and you know, the other guys can all sort of shout it and telling you got to do this, you got to do that. I mean, they made him look terrible. I mean, whether Tyson just, he didn't, well, I don't think he listened to a word they were saying, to be honest. He didn't look that way, but it was just a mess. The whole thing is laughable, and it was just all building up to the point you're just thinking, Buster's just going to just beat him for 12 rounds.
It was really bad, the stuff that happened in the corner that night. And as you say, it was, they obviously wasn't prepared for the fact that this fight was going to go anywhere past three or four rounds, because the fact that they didn't have the right equipment, the corner equipment that they should have had, it's like a mini iron to push the swelling around. It's to get rid of the swelling around the eye. They didn't even have it. That was unbelievable, to see the fact that they had a latex glove filled with ice water and they were using it to try and reduce the swelling on his eye. And then how ineffectual the corner was, I can't even imagine being sat there with a swollen eye and one of your cornermen is leaning down and his identification badge chain literally rips across the swelling in your eye. It's not great enough getting punched in the face as it is, and then to have swelling on your eye, to have some sort of pain already, and then someone come across with a chain literally dragging it across your swollen eye. I can't even imagine. Now, Tyson, man, he was a tough man. Now, if he winced at that, that must have been very, very painful for him at the time, for that to happen. But that was, again, just part of the catastrophic night it was turning out to be. And the corner was ridiculous. I mean, it was one of the biggest mistakes I think they made in this fight, was the fact that they didn't have an experienced corner. No disrespect to any of the guys in the corner, but the corner wasn't experienced enough for a fight of this magnitude, really, for Mike, in terms of Mike Tyson. And they didn't think about the fact that James Buster Douglas was there to actually fight and potentially win the fight. He was just there thinking, yeah, he's going to knock this guy out, like everyone was saying, he's going to knock this guy out within 90 seconds. And it just got worse and worse. Confusion and panic just begin to grow in the corner as the rounds went on. They're not even giving him proper advice at all. They're basically telling him the same thing they told him from round one, which is to just move your head, jab your way inside, and just throw the right hand. And in the eighth round, this was a round that Douglas dominated until the last few seconds of the round, and HBO's Larry Murphy Merchant basically said in commentary, Douglas is asking of Tyson some questions he hasn't been asked before. In the last few rounds of a fight, you have to come back and win it. And this was something Tyson had not experienced at all before. Well, just going back to the end of the eighth round, Tyson, you know, this was a brilliant shot that he landed. A big right uppercut after being backed onto the ropes that had sent Douglas down to the canvas and caused what was one of the most controversial moments in boxing history. Aside from the eventual outcome of this fight, this was also a very controversial moment, and also something that happened quite recently in modern boxing with Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder, where the timekeeper started the count at a certain point. Now, people's interpretation of the 10 count is that as soon as that fighter's back or hand or knee touches the floor, the count starts immediately. The count doesn't start until the referee starts the count, and that's what a lot of people forget when it comes to boxing. So going through then, getting to the controversial moment, and I want to know what your take is on this, because this was something that wouldn't be left to lie even after the fight.
I've never seen this happen before with Mike Tyson. He's always been the initiator. Here he's against the ropes. I've never seen.
And there's a right hand uppercut, and down goes Douglas. As suddenly as that.
Can he beat the count?
He got a little overconfident. Got a little loosey-goosey. Still wobbly. Let's see what Mike can do to finish. And the bell ends to save Buster Douglas at the end of round eight.
I think Tyson still believes that it was a ten count, and he should have ended the fight with that. But as you precisely spot on, Sean, it isn't the timekeeper. The timekeeper will start the count, but I believe the referee actually started his count a couple of seconds after. So it was a longer 10 count, but it's a referee's count. You've got to remember that. You know if you asked, I don't know, 10 people to count to 10, and you actually timed it, I reckon 5 of them people will get the 10 on time when they stop the clock, as soon as they say 10. Others will go over, some will probably go a little bit slower, because that's just the way it is. It's never, you know, it's not a clock. People just need to just get that out of their heads. Even Deontay Wilder did it, and Tyson done it with this fight. Wilder done it, as you said, with Fury, where they're using a clock. So as soon as he goes down, it's not the case. It's the referee's count. So, you know, although it was over 10 seconds, he was up at 9. Some referees could have called it off, but the bell did ring, and I think he probably thought, look, he's up, he's got 2 feet before 10, I'm going to give him his chance and send him to the corner, he's winning the fight. So I think that's good refereeing.
Yeah, no, it definitely was good refereeing, because this at this point was going to be argued a lot after the event had happened, after the end of the fight. So then we go into what was a dramatic ninth round. You knew what was going to happen. Douglas was hurt. Douglas came out with only a minute's rest for the ninth round, and we all knew, as fans, as commentators, that Tyson was going to come out and try and finish the show, basically. He came out really aggressively to try and end the fight and save his title, because at this point he's losing quite badly, and he was hoping that he was going to be able to get Douglas and hurt him. He was, you know, clearly still hurt from that eighth round knockdown, because you got to remember it happened the last 10 seconds of the eighth round as well, so he was still a bit dazed from the fact that he took that great uppercut. But Douglas was actually able to fight back and fight off Tyson and close Tyson's eye completely. Some of the punches that were traded in this particular round was brilliant. There was a four punch combination that staggered Tyson back to the ropes, and then with Tyson hurt along the ropes, Douglas closed in and unleashed a vicious four punch attack to try and knock Tyson out, and then Tyson came back trying to fight Douglas off, but it was in vain, because at this point his gas tank is going, he's losing the fight, his eyes swollen up, Douglas is trying his best to finish the fight, Tyson's trying to fight back. At the end of the round comes to a close, and Tyson had managed to withstand the punishment, and for me, he'd only just about survived that ninth round after what was a huge round and a huge comeback round for Buster Douglas. And when we talk about rounds in fights and some of the greatest rounds we've covered in some of the episodes quite recently, this has got to be one of the most underrated rounds in boxing ever.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. We do neglect the fact that, you know, with round nine in particular, because with the amount of other stuff that's going on, you know, we're even surrounded a fight beforehand, and then the actual shock of the fight,
and then the long count. So it sort of, you forget how good this round is. I even forgot watching it back again how good round nine is. I just always expecting to see the end, like the two knockdowns in 8 and 10 sort of neglect 9, but it was brilliant. It was literally one of the most dramatic rounds you will see in boxing. You know, I advise anyone to just go and look at the ninth if you don't want to watch the whole fight. You know, fine, I would watch the whole fight, but the ninth round in particular is a brilliant fight. You know, as you say, he staggered Tyson and Tyson looked hurt, and then he just looked like it was inevitable that Tyson eventually the referee's going to stop it. But I mean, to Tyson's credit, I mean, he withstood a lot of punishment. He barely survived round 9, but you know, it wasn't looking good. And I think with Tyson obviously putting it down in the eighth, I think, as you say, he's come out aggressively. He's tried to take him out early, and he emptied that gas tank in that sort of first minute because he couldn't get rid of him. And Douglas showed he also has got a good chin. And he put to bed all those, you know, the rumours and what people mentioned about Douglas when he fought Tucker. Because he by this point against Tucker, he probably would have just given. And anyone could have just, you know, if he'd have got 8-9 rounds and then it was counted off or the referee stopped it, or he did decide, you know what, I've had enough, then no one would have ever, people would have still said that, you know, what a fantastic fight he gave Tyson. But to his credit, maybe with his mum dying and just other things going on in his head, he just battled through it and then just turned it again. And seeing Tyson in that sort of trouble was unbelievable to see.
It was, and that 10th and final round of the fight was iconic. It's history-making. It's one of the greatest ends to a fight you'll ever see because of the significance of what it meant to boxing and boxing history. We had the guy who was the baddest man on the planet, the guy who was touted to go on and break that record of Joe Louis's 25 title defences, the guy that was just an unbelievable fighter for the 1980s and was obviously a history making guy, a guy who we still talk about today, a guy we put there amongst the best heavyweights ever. But this 10th round, Tyson knew, coming out of that corner, he just knew he had no choice but to push this fight. Obviously, in his mind, he was losing quite bad, and although the scorecards told us a different story, which we'll talk about at the end of this particular round, he obviously knew he was behind. He obviously knew he was potentially on the verge of losing this fight, so he come out, even though he was still clearly affected from that previous round, and he tried to walk forward, he tried to walk Douglas down, but Douglas straight away, he just measured him with a few jabs before landing what was a devastating uppercut. It rocked Tyson back, stopping him in his tracks. Tyson obviously trying to come back again, he's trying to walk forward, trying to land his own shots through, but Douglas immediately followed that through with the 4 punches to the head, which dropped Tyson for the first time in his professional career in what was one of the most famous scenes of Mike Tyson trying to beat the count, fumbling around, looking for his mouthpiece on the floor, and as he managed to try to get to his feet, the referee had seen enough, counted him out. Buster Douglas then becomes the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world and one of the biggest upsets in boxing history.
Rolling willingly just to try to get in the shot that will finish things in.
Oh, the uppercut.
What an uppercut by Douglas. Tyson. And down goes Tyson.
It's over.
It's over. Mike Tyson has been knocked out.
Unbelievable. This makes Cinderella look like a sad story, what Buster Douglas has done here tonight.
Let's go ahead and call it the biggest upset in the history of heavyweight championship fights. Say it now, gentlemen. James Buster Douglas, undisputed heavyweight champion of the world.
That again, the 10th round was brilliant. I mean, Douglas, you could see he knew he had him from that 9. I think in his head, he's thinking, oh, God, now I wonder if that was my chance at the end of 9. You just wonder if that was it. But I mean, even Douglas, he still knew in his head, he thought after round 9, it's just going to be another, you know, it's going to be another, it's going to be 10, it's going to be 11, it's going to be 12, and we're going to go to the judges' scorecards. So he's going to need to win the fight. He didn't believe he was going to stop Tyson. And he even said that when he did put Tyson down, even when Tyson was on the floor, Douglas expected Tyson to get up. He said it wasn't until he sort of scrambled for the gum shield that he realised he'd got him. He thought, I've done it. I've done it. That was the moment in his head. And it was a bizarre thing to do. And it's one of the most famous pictures you could ever see of Tyson on the deck with that mouthpiece in his hand. And you do wonder, you know, with everything, what was he thinking? Why didn't he just try and... What was the point of going for the mouthpiece? Just leave the mouthpiece on the floor and get up. And you would have made the 10 count. But, you know, I mean, he did effectively get up on 9. He was up, but he was staggering. And the referee, again, made a big call, and he made a right call. But, it was a great finish from Buster Douglas. And it was an unbelievable viewing just to see Tyson in the trouble he was in. And just that famous, the gun still hanging out of his mouth or in the corner of his lip. And the referee calling it off. So, yeah, big, big, big shock. And credit to Busto. He was brilliant throughout the whole fight. The only one knock he could have is obviously that eighth round getting caught with a one left hook. It really put him down. As you did say, as you mentioned before, Sean, he was caught with a few left hooks. So it wasn't like it was just a one punch. He had been caught with those left hooks to the body, to the head, a few times during the fight. That one in particular put him down in the eighth. But all credit to Douglas. He battled bravely and he deserved his victory. He was the better man of the night. And yeah, moving on to the aftermath of Don King, who weren't too best pleased about it, was how the fight went. And he was just, you know, as you said, you could talk for hours about Don King. And that geezer was an absolute snake. So credit to Buster. Really pleased for the guy. And what a great victory for him to be the first man to not only put Tyson down, but to beat him.
Buster Douglas, undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. Can you believe that?
Yeah, it's happening. Take this off.
Why did it happen, James?
Because I wanted it.
Why? Why did you win this fight that nobody on the planet gave you?
Because his mother.
In what way?
God bless her heart.
Yeah, and as I was talking about the scorecards earlier, through the 9 rounds, it was scored 87-86 for Tyson, 86-86 even, and 88-83 for Douglas, which was the card, after watching it back, I felt was the most accurate card out of the three. But subsequently, something that a lot of people may or may not know about this fight was two of the three judges were Japanese judges for this particular fight, with it being held in Tokyo. And that makes me think whether that dunking money was paid them Japanese judges off, because how they had one round to Tyson and 86-86 even is still beyond me looking back on that fight. The American judge, ironically, was the one that gave it 88-83 for Douglas, which I felt was the most accurate score of the fight. And yeah, going back to it, it's unbelievable to think that two of the judges had it so close, and obviously one of them had Tyson in front as well.
It's beyond me. Blatantly something dodgy going on there. I mean, even Bert Sugar said that I can't think if he said he was there, but he's been on the way to try and speak with the judges to find out what they were scoring and tripped over their guide dogs. So, you know, it was terrible. I mean, blatantly corruption involved. You know, there's no weight, no bones about it. And Don King, the king of corruption. So, yeah, I'm glad for Buster Douglas that he did put Tyson away, because that would have been unbelievable if that had gone to the scorecards and Tyson had won that fight, because there was no way in hell Tyson. I think I would give Tyson a round, to be honest with you. I think I'd give every round, well, apart from obviously the eighth, but then even then in the eighth, I had Buster Douglas winning the round because it happened so late in the eighth. So, you know, for me, I would score that 10-9 before the knockdown, and then obviously with the knockdown it then becomes an 8. So, you know, effectively it's a 9-8, isn't it, really? So it's probably the one round that Tyson wins. So yeah, I have no idea what the hell they were watching.
No, definitely weren't. And as you was alluding to a short while ago, in the immediate aftermath of the fight, Tyson's camp, led by Don King, protested the result, and the post-fight press conference was funny as anything. If you go on and watch it, you had Don King, you had all Tyson's team all sat there with a little TV that they'd rolled in out of that room in the primary school that you used to see, where they'd bring the TV out back in the 90s, and they'd had the TV and they had a replay of the count of Douglas beating being down on the ground, and they're all sat there counting it on the fingers, and Don King's like, no, I'm not having this. So as a result of his complaints, the WBC and WBA initially agreed and suspended recognition of Douglas as the champion. And although the IBF immediately accepted that the result was valid after a public outcry and demands from boxing commissions around the world that they acknowledge Douglas as the champion, the protest was eventually withdrawn and Douglas was recognised 4 days after the fight, in spite of the fact that he had an inspired and dominant performance. And the majority of boxing fans around the world knew you know, that he was the champion. Nobody was contesting the count of Douglas being down other than Don King and his camp, and he was so close to getting that decision overturned or put as a no contest. I tell you what, it was, that would have absolutely ruined boxing history if that would have happened, but it was very, very close, and there's a lot of people that may not know how close it was to ending up becoming a no contest.
It was disgusting, it really was, and the fact that the WBA and WBC wouldn't recognise him straight away is just ridiculous, and it just shows you with these organisations, even today, that, you know, when someone like Don King's got the money and the clout and power, he's able to influence his governing bodies, that it was, nobody else would even doubt in it. I mean, all right, fine, it was a long count, but again, you know, there's no denying that that Buster Douglas won that fight. And, you know, I say long count, it's not, it's a referee's count, it's 2 seconds out from a timed count, but again, it was a long count. I think they both had long counts, in actual fact, that I think the referee's count was almost identical to the count that Douglas had. So, you know, end of the day, it is what it was, and that is just disgraceful from the other two organisations. I'm pleased the IBF recognised him immediately. You know, I'm pleased for Buster Douglas that eventually was given, you know, given that the titles. I mean, and also he was on the cover. He was the cover photo of the Sports Illustrated with the title, and it said Rocky Lives on the front as well. If you can see a picture of that. And Tyson was also supposed to, a little WWF fact. Tyson was supposed to be on make an appearance in February 1990 on WWF, the main event, special guest as a special guest referee. But in actual fact, because Tyson lost, they gave it to Buster Douglas instead. So he made his way to the WWF to referee and about to see Hulk Hogan and Macho Man Randy Savage. So there's a little key fact there for you, I thought, for the WWE fans.
So after the fight, there were obviously plans for various matchups to take place. So they tried to get a rematch with Douglas, and that didn't happen. So eventually, Douglas went on to fight the number one contender, who was Evander Holyfield. Now, going into the fight with Holyfield, Douglas weighed 14.5 pounds more than what he did for the fight with Tyson, and eventually was knocked out by Holyfield in the third round. For Douglas, he retired after this fight, as what you alluded to earlier, and then 6 years later, he launched a comeback after almost dying in a diabetic coma. He did win a few fights against journeyman opposition, and he ended up fighting for the last time in 1999. There was a lot of rumours that he was going to end up rematching Tyson throughout the 90s, but they never ended up facing off again, which was quite strange and sad. But I suppose in some respects it's what makes this fight a beautiful tale to tell, really, is the fact that he was a guy who seemingly had not done enough to put himself in that position, although he did on paper. He was a guy that ended up he didn't go on to do anything afterwards. After, it was like a Rocky story. He won the world titles, lost them in his next fight, and never went on to do anything significant again. For Tyson, obviously the rest is history, really. I don't want to touch too much on Tyson's career after that, because there's so many other nights which we could record for Legendary Nights. It's unbelievable. But at the time he lost to Douglas, they'd actually been negotiating for a fight with a former sparring partner, Greg Page. There was also talks of him fighting George Foreman when he returned to the ring. That would have been promoted by the Sultan of Brunei as well, which was unbelievable. That Don King money again, talking. But just imagine the possibilities of Mike Tyson versus George Foreman in the 90s. That's just something that sort of whets the appetite. It's a fantasy fight.
It really would. That would have been a cracking fight, actually. But as you say, with Tyson after his career, I mean, you could do Legendary Nights for a lot of it. But what one
thing I just wanted to pick up with Evander Holyfield, with the Evander Holyfield fight, was that it actually, the Mirage Casino won the right to promote the fight themselves. They actually won a purse bid by bidding $32.1 million, which is still today a record. They actually beat Holyfield's promoter, Main Event, who bidded, I believe it was something like $20 million or $29 million. But so the Mirage Casino, Steve Wynn, he was the owner of the Mirage, he promoted the fight himself. And he found that Douglas was putting on this weight, as you alluded to earlier, and he was concerned about it. So he actually sorted a private suite with a sauna for Douglas to try and sweat off his weight and make sure he gets himself into shape. But he was pissed off later on to find out that he was actually ordering room service from his sauna and spending $98 worth on food. So, you know, it was clearly, you know, enjoying his life. I mean, it was guaranteed, or he did get a $24.6 million payday, you know, for the Holyfield fight. So he was in a great position, wasn't he, really? I mean, he did probably just surrender the fight. He put on way too much weight. And even on the weigh-ins, when the weigh-ins came in, so many people just went, put money on Holyfield straight from the weigh-in, because, you know, he had come in so much heavier than the fight. So, yeah, it's just, Buster Douglas, obviously, you know, he'd always remembered for this win, and rightly so. But you know, after that, it was just one of them things. I think he earned his money, and then that was it, wasn't it? You know, I think he got like 3 million for the title fight. He walked away with 24.6 million, you know, for the Holyfield fight. So good for him. He made his money, and it is a bit like a Cinderella man, like, you know, you mentioned as well, like with a few others with Rocky. But you know, you beat the man, like Cinderella man, as in Broderick, he beats Max Baer and then loses to Joe Louis straight away. And it's the same sort of thing with Buster Douglas. Beats one of the most dangerous heavyweights around of all time and then just gets annihilated by Evander Holyfield. But you know, unfortunate for Buster, but yes, it is what it is. It's just a great, great fight to cover.
And this for me was the end of the amazing Tyson era, to be honest, because after this particular fight had happened, he would go on to fight four more times before being convicted of raping a beauty pageant contestant in 1991. And for me, when he spent obviously them years in prison, they were essentially his best years of his career. Well, you know, when he came back, I don't think he was ever the same again. And again, there's some nights which we'll probably talk about in the future for Legendary Nights, but they'll never compare to the era of the 80s and obviously very early 90s and up to this point where he lost the fight to James Buster Douglas. That was the Mike Tyson that everybody will always compare to the greats like Muhammad Ali and Joe Louis and Rocky Marciano. That was the Tyson that everybody thought was one of the best, you know, heavyweights of all time. After that, I don't think his career was ever the same. And this was, for me, this was the start of his downfall as a fighter. Although he would eventually end up fighting on until around 2005, this was the beginning of the end, really. This loss to Buster Douglas, for me, was the beginning of the end of the baddest man on the planet.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think he lost that fear factor. I think one thing that Buster Douglas proved is that he wasn't this animal. He was actually mortal. He's human. This guy you can actually get to him and you can take him out. And he sort of lost that aura about him. So the fighters went into the ring a little bit more confident. I mean, following the Buster Douglas loss anyway, I mean, he did fight Henry Tillman, who Tillman actually beat Tyson twice in the build-up to the 84 Olympics, and he actually went on to win the gold medal. So there was a little bit of history between them. So that was a good victory for him to come out of that Buster Douglas to beat Henry Tillman. But obviously, the Donovan Ruddock fight's almost irrelevant because, you know, he goes into prison and, you know, he loses those prime years in his career. I mean, it's hard to believe if Tyson was around for those 6 years, you know, what he could have gone on to achieve. Even with this defeat, you know, he could have gone on to dominate even more and have, who knows what he could have done, because he was still devastating. And he is still, quite rightly so, you know, up there with one of the best heavyweights ever that's ever lived. And I think there's, you know,
But like you say, he lost blatantly, you know, the two of Evander Holyfield fights, for instance. You know, he was just losing his way a little bit. The one thing I always remember as well, when he came out of prison, it was his first fight against Peter McNeely. I think he lost in a disqualification, McNeely, but it was his first fight coming back from prison, coming out of prison. And it was billed as he's back. And I just, that always sent a shiver down my spine, because I always see, like, Mike Tyson, like, you know, coming through the door like Johnny in The Shining, you know. Johnny, it's just a petrifying thought of Mike Tyson going out of prison. It's like, just lock up your daughters, mate, because you know what, this guy's just sniffing around. But yeah, I'm with you, mate. It was a shame, because, you know, as you say, they were peak years for Tyson. I mean, he may have peaked early, maybe this was the downside for him, but I still think with someone, you know, someone like Kevin Rooney, if he was in his corner, for instance, he probably would have got through that fight against Buster Douglas, because he would have had the right equipment and he would have given the right advice, but had him in the right frame of mind. But yeah, he lost something in that fight. Well, what he did lose was the fear factor, although he did, you know, he done Bruno again, didn't he, as well. So, but yeah, just a great fight to Coventry, and just, it's just great to just look back on Mike Tyson fights. Just, yeah, it's just brilliant.
And that is the episode. That is the tale of Mike Tyson versus James Buster Douglas from way back in February 1990. I hope everybody that's listened to this episode has really enjoyed it. There was so much to cover off, so many details, so many facts, stuff that you may have known, stuff that you may have not known, stuff that I've learned while recording this episode. So I tell you, I've really enjoyed doing this one, because it was one of, if not the greatest upset in sporting history. It was the greatest upset in boxing history of all time, in my opinion, and it was such an enjoyable episode to cover that I think it was for me probably the best one we've done for Legendary Nights to date.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's, you know, it's not just about the fight, it was just everything else that surrounded it. You know, Mike Tyson was ferocious, terrifying. You know, he terrified the life out of all of his opponents. And Buster just wasn't scared. He went in there that night and he'd done what nobody else had done. It seemed impossible that no one could stop him. But then in 1990 in Tokyo, Tyson self-destruct, Buster Douglas beats him, and, well, what a legendary night to cover.
So that's it, guys. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, the Legendary Nights tale of Tyson versus Douglas. If you've enjoyed this, as per all the other episodes, please go and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Podbean, Stitcher, Spreaker, Player FM, Spotify. It will be on Eat Sleep Boxing Repeat's YouTube channel if you prefer to listen to it through there as well. Go and find us on social media at BTR Boxing Pod. Follow us, tell all your friends about us, get sharing the episodes around social media, because it truly helps us grow as a platform and as a podcast. And find us on Facebook as well at BTR Boxing Podcast. Share it all around there too. We really, really appreciate all the support that you've been giving to us. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, the tale of Mike Tyson versus James Buster Douglas.
You can write everything down if you want to. Be brave enough to write every one of your goals down. But I'm going to tell you something. Life's going to hit you in your mouth, and you got to do me a huge favor. Your why has to be greater than that knockdown. And I love it. Buster Douglas got knocked out. Nobody ever got knocked out by Mike Tyson and ever got back up. It was almost a 10 count. He was stumbling. They were 4, 3, 2, and he... 1, ding, 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 saved by the bell. He goes to his corner. The whole world is like, yep, that's it. Once he comes back out, that's it. Mike's going to just hammer him. And exactly that, Mike Tyson came out like, I got him. I got this kid up against the rope. Listen to me, many of you right now, life's got you up against the rope. You can't give up. You can't give in. Listen to me, if it was easy, everybody would do it. And if life's got you backed up, I need you to do what Buster Douglas did. Buster Douglas started fighting back. The world was shocked. Goliath has been knocked down. What happened? And they went to Buster Douglas and they asked Buster Douglas simply, like, what happened? And Buster Douglas said, listen to me, it's real simple. Before my mother died, she told the whole world that I was going to beat Mike Tyson. Buster Douglas had a decision to make. When his mother died, he could die with his mother, or he made a decision, I can wake up and I can live for mom. And he knocked Mike Tyson out simply because his why was greater than that punch. His why was greater than defeat. His why was greater than his trial and his tribulation. And I'm telling you, if you don't know what your why is and your why isn't strong, you're going to get knocked out every single day.
Sports
Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.